This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, yet another unexpected new legal assault on Obamacare.
We in Oklahoma made a decision not to set up a state health care exchange, and the IRS has come into our state trying to assess the employer mandate penalty, and we have sued the IRS saying that that's violates the congressional intent and the congressional language that's found in the ACA.
Also, a high-profile campaign to raise the minimum wage. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, the crossword puzzle turns 100, and we'll talk about its history and future with the one and only Will Schwartz. And then, the new HBO series about the end of life, Getting On.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Robinson. Cuckoo, ca-choo.
Oh, that's I am the walrus.
No, just a joke. How are we feeling today?
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Obama administration claims major improvements in healthcare.gov. At the same time, the state of Oklahoma has launched yet another legal battle to destroy the Affordable Care Act. Will it succeed? Then, fast food workers go on strike to raise the minimum wage. Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor, Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
The slow-moving disaster that is the implementation of Obamacare had two new twists this week. First, the administration announced that it had more or less met its goal of having healthcare.gov substantively working by November 30th. We're going to talk about what that means. Second, a judge in D.C. ruled that plaintiffs have standing to sue in a challenge to yet another key provision of Obamacare. This suit claims that under the law, the federal government cannot give subsidies or issue penalties to anyone who signs up for Obamacare through the federal exchanges. They can only do it for the minority of states that have their own state exchanges, so that the subsidies that make insurance affordable for many, many people won't be available to people through the federal exchanges under this theory. If this is successful, this lawsuit would, I think we could probably safely say, would utterly gut the Affordable Care Act. So we're going to talk about whether it has a chance and where it's going. So, John, the Obama administration claims that uptime is at 95% on healthcare.gov, that page loads are at 1 second, and that more and more people are able to complete the whole process of signing up for insurance. Any decent website has an uptime of way over 99%. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the majority of people, or even 80% of people, let's say, in the best case, are able to complete the process of signing up for insurance through the healthcare.gov website somehow doesn't hearten me.
Right.
But should I be heartened?
You should be heartened in that it's better than it was when it was in a state of total collapse. I mean, one of the things about these numbers, you understand those numbers and put them in context, but it's like if they said, you know, the Thrapernator is operating at maximum efficiency for put time at the juncture 6, right? And you'd be like, wow, really?
The Thrapernator.
Awesome. So the problem here is that, like, they're saying we've made 600 bug fixes. Well, okay, great, but compared to what and how valuable are those fixes and so forth and so on. So we're basically have to take them at their word that they've got the thing up and running. And as we saw from a very good TikTok of the disaster from October 1st to December 1st and how it was handled, throughout it, the administration was in two different postures with respect to information it was giving to the public. It was either actively misleading the public, or it was misleading the public because it didn't know what was actually going on with the site itself. So we don't know whether it's snapped out of those two postures and whether what it's telling us is true or not. What we can say is that lots more people appear to be signing up, not just because the administration says so, but because there are a lot more sort of stories of people being able to get through and it being smooth, and there are fewer stories of people having lots and lots of difficulties. And I should say the third thing is that the administration is putting on this big sell to get people to sign up, and they would be insane to do that if the website weren't working at some level. But they are in some ways a little bit insane because while the website is working, the so-called back end, where the insurance companies get the information, is still not working very well. And in fact, they delayed the fix of that portion of the system while they were fixing the website itself. So what's happening is insurance companies are getting some faulty information. They're not getting some information in some cases. And if that's the case, then you can think you've signed up, but then you haven't signed up. And that could create a huge problem, which they've now exacerbated by sending all new kinds of applicants there. And so for them to say that it's kind of up and running is only a part of the story.
Yes. So, Emily, I think it was a Washington Post story suggested that as many as a third, is that right? A third of the people who have signed up for insurance through the Affordable Care Act may not have signed up for the thing that they expect, that it may not have processed correctly.
They're getting a new blender.
Incredibly alarming. Also, we learned that the number of young people signing up for Obamacare seems to be very low. The administration wanted it to be at least 35% young people in the pool of people getting insurance. It appears to be way less than that. Maybe as less than a quarter of the people getting insurance are the young people that the administration says it needs. So what is the administration to do with all of this? Is there a way to salvage it that you see?
I think they can do the best campaign they can, but this is it seems like this is a solvable problem, right? This was about the website malfunctioning. Once it's up and running, if this is a good program, it will sell. But it's damaged in terms of people's perceptions of whether it's a success or not. And so the idea that you're going to be excited to be part of this new toy that the government is wheeling out, I think that's all gone. And that might be particularly damaging for young people in terms of signing up. I also feel, though, that every time we talk about this, the notion that it's going to fail, we make it more likely that it's going to fail because it just seems less and less of like an appealing, attractive program. And it depends on market share.
Wait, so, but Emily, there was claims.
I'm not saying we shouldn't do it.
There were some progressives saying this week, oh, liberal journalists, you should not talk about how bad everything is.
No, I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about it. But I do think that
I agree with both of you.
Yeah. I just think that the perception of it as failing contributes to it failing because it's a product. And like all products, when you're selling it in the marketplace, if it starts to seem like a lemon, then nobody wants a part of it.
Matt Iglesias made the case in Slate this week that this failure has really damaged the progressive cause for the future, that people are going to be incredibly skeptical about the idea that government really is a solution, federal government in particular really is a solution. It's going to be a very hard sell for anybody because this has been such a high-profile fiasco. Do you see anything to that, John?
Well, okay, so one of the problems here is that for the majority, as we've talked about a million times before, for the people who have health insurance, their fear is that this big government program was going to mess up their health insurance. And so you have a huge people with a political interest to be against this if they're worried that it's going to screw up their insurance. So in a sense, you had people kind of girding against this government program from the start. You can imagine in the future, if they wanted a government program, if it was reversed and most of the people wanted the government program, they'd be fine with it, you know, because they want the promised product in the end. To that extent, somebody promising big government action to solve a problem isn't necessarily damaged. It just sort of depends on whether people want that solution. But if people don't want the solution and you're trying to bring them along to it and convince them it's the right thing to do, then this does make it that much harder because they think here the government couldn't do this thing. It had several years to do. It wasn't a surprise. And they, you know, screwed it up royally.
What do you think, Emily?
I think that's about right, that it's neither the absolute calamity forever, but that it's going to make it harder for us to believe in this kind of a mechanism for solving problems.
And also, there's a lot of distrust in the government, period, for a variety of other reasons as well. And so, you know, if this had happened in the middle of a period where everybody was happy with the operations of government, it would have been not as bad. But this builds on to and compounds an existing distrust of government and institution, big institutions.
Let's pivot, actually, to this very interesting, disheartening lawsuit that's been brought by the Attorney General of Oklahoma, somebody named something Pruitt. I forgot his first name. And he is making a legal argument that is pretty profound. Emily, can you outline it?
He is making the argument that Obamacare, just you look at the text of the law, that it authorizes subsidies for people getting health care only if they get it through the state exchanges. not if they get it through the federal exchanges. And this is looms much larger than it would have otherwise because there's so many states that have refused to set up their own exchanges. And he has text of statute to cite. If you look, if you zero in on the particular clause in this huge, huge law that talks about setting up the state exchanges, it refers to a number in the law, Section 1311, that's about the state exchanges, not about a federal one. So the question is whether that clear reading of that line of the statute trumps lots of other places in the law in which it's clear that Congress was contemplating the federal government having a greater role in these exchanges. And I don't think it's a slam dunk for the federal government at all.
Oh, really? Why?
Let's talk. Can we talk about first the implications and then get to the where this case is going? The implications, just if this lawsuit succeeded, it would be illegal for the federal government to give subsidies to people who are getting their insurance through the federal exchanges. As a result, the insurance costs for those people would be much, much, much higher. They wouldn't sign up. It wouldn't be worth it. Right. And also, they couldn't be penalized. There's another thing, which is the people who are signing up through the federal exchanges could not be penalized. Therefore, the IRS couldn't punish them for not getting insurance.
Right.
The law would collapse.
The subsidies and the penalties are
the thing that
push people into line to sign up. Without that, they don't sign up.
Okay, so why is this a strong case, and what was the legal action that occurred this week?
Well, the federal district court judge who's overseeing this case refused to just throw it out of court on what's called a motion to dismiss. That means it passed a low bar, but the first bar to actually being developed as a case on the merits. You know, the reason I think this isn't a slam dunk for the federal government is the rules of statutory interpretation. I mean, this is going to get into the weeds really quickly, and I didn't take the class called legislation in law school because essentially my eyes glaze over whenever I try to read a statute. You know, there's a pretty persuasive body of scholarship that's arguing that Congress is increasingly writing unclear laws and just kind of throwing up its hands and asking the agencies to figure this out afterward because they can't come to agreement. That probably wasn't what was going on with Obamacare. I mean, we're talking about this gargantuan law that had tons of text in it. And it's entirely possible that this particular line was just like a bad oversight and just poorly written. Or maybe, as the people bringing this case from the Cato Institute and Jonathan Adler, who's the law professor behind it, they're making an argument that, no, this was about Congress trying to promote the state exchanges and prevent the federal government, or at least like give it less of a role here. I don't think there's really any evidence for that. But if you were just taking this part of the law, then I think this lawsuit would succeed. The problem is, okay, when do you read statutes in a way where you just zero in on the plain reading of one line of text? And when do you read them in such a way where you take into account the intent of the entire law and you pull other pieces in from other places in this giant statute and then try to interpret everything together? And there basically are different rules of statutory construction, and the challengers are trying to argue plain meaning in this very strict way. And the Obama administration is defending the law by saying, no, you want to make sure you read it as a whole so that no part becomes absurd or just doesn't fit. And that's the debate.
Coming up, fast food workers go on strike to raise the minimum wage. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. A pro-labor coalition mostly led by the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, organized a one-day strike at fast food restaurants in 100 cities on Thursday. At the time we're taping, it is not clear how successful the strike was or is, but it's certainly drawn attention to the movement to raise the federal minimum wage for fast food workers and other workers from $7.25 to $15. This is a wildly ambitious number. Washington, D.C., for example, a very liberal place, has just pushed the wage here from $8.25 to $11.50, or the city council has passed that. It's not in effect yet. So $15 would be incredibly high. The supporters of a federal minimum wage hike note that the effective federal minimum wage has dropped by $3 an hour in the past generation, and it should be at least $10 to keep pace with what it was. Opponents of hiking the federal minimum wage, or any minimum wage, say it restricts businesses from innovating, raises unemployment, raises prices, and generally acts as a drag on the economy. So, John, President Obama gave a speech this week. He talked about the minimum wage a little bit. What position is he trying to stake out here?
Well, he wants the minimum wage just to raise to $10, so he's not going all the way. It's very interesting, both from policy standpoint and also politically, but he basically said this is what the focus of my administration will be for the remaining 3 years. And that is essentially what the focus has been since he's been running for the presidency, which is to try to restore the bargain at the heart of the American experience, which is that if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll have a chance. And so he's tackling the two big issues of income inequality and the lack of social mobility. You know, and we can cite all kinds of different statistics that incomes essentially have flatlined since, depending on how you measure it, since the 80s, or that since the recovery, 95% of the gains since 2007 have gone to the top 1%. You know, there are millions of statistics you can put forward. And his argument is we need to correct this balance, and the minimum wage is at the heart of that. I argued that he's not going to get anywhere with the minimum wage in the same way he had trouble. I mean, he mentioned this in his State of the Union. He's mentioned a series of these programs. Early childhood education is another one. Investment for different kinds of worker training. College costs, bringing them down, is another part of this effort to reorganize the winners and losers in the current state of the economy. That actually the best thing he can do for inequality is make sure his health care plan survives, because for the 2/3 of the people who are signing up who had no kind of insurance at all ever, this is the best thing you can do for them to ameliorate the effects of being on the losing side of an economy that's been tilted. Because the law is passed, and as tricky and troublesome as it's been, he can actually do something, as opposed to with some of these other measures where he's basically going to be stymied by the House Republicans.
Right. So, Emily, all signs are that there is no chance the Congress, as currently constituted, would raise the federal minimum wage, right?
Right. And yet, I mean, hearing about how low it is compared to what it was in the 1960s made my heart drop, because you just think of the notion that you would be working full time and still be under the poverty line for yourself and your children. There should be something dismaying about that, shouldn't there?
Yeah. I mean, I find there was a great John Cassidy article in The New Yorker about this, about the minimum wage case. And it's very interesting. So the basic case against raising the federal minimum wage is that it raises unemployment, that it reduces corporate independence, that it mainly helps teenagers, and that it raises prices. There basically isn't any evidence for certainly the first three of those. That if you look at unemployment rates in states with higher minimum wages, there's no apparent connection between employment and minimum wage. There are places with high minimum wage with lower unemployment, places with low minimum wage with high unemployment. The labor market fluctuations appear to have very little to do with minimum wage. And it is true that this constrains corporations that have to then pay higher wages to their employees. On the other hand, there are lots of ways in which government has constrained employees by making them do things, you know, providing bathroom breaks or not requiring employees to work in hazardous conditions. There are things that the federal government is constantly doing. And there's a movement on the right which says, no, corporations should not be constrained in this way. They should be free to innovate and do what they want, and we should get rid of these restrictions. And if workers don't like it, they're free to vote with their feet, not work there, and go work elsewhere at a place which has different working conditions. And that just doesn't take into account the fact that really, if you're poor, if you're living in a lot of places in this country with limited access to employment, limited access to transportation, limited education, you have very little SWAT as a worker to do anything. The power of workers relative to employers has never been lower than it is now. And the only countervailing force about that right now is government, because unions have been so gutted and government has the power to raise the minimum wage, but it just simply won't do it because there's such a strong position on the right against it.
Another argument against raising it, though, which was intriguing to me, is that in CBO, the last time that we had this debate, I think it was the last time anyway, did an analysis of if you raise the minimum wage to $7.25, that would increase wages by $11 billion, $1.6 billion of which went to the poor. By contrast, if you increase the earned income tax credit, which goes directly to large families that are poor, it would cost about $2.4 billion, of which $1.4 billion would go to the poor. So you get greater bang for your buck through things like EITC than you do through minimum wage if your goal is to get at the poor and
well,
fix the inequality.
Both of those things can be true. You can say EITC is a worthwhile project to expand.
But I guess
in the
political triage that will happen, right? So this pressure on inequality is going to continue to grow. Republicans are going to have to come up with some kind of argument against it, because one of the problems they have at the federal level is not just the demographic challenges, but the fact that they lack kind of a middle class agenda. And so there's been some searching in the Republican ranks to try and come up with something that would stand in for that. So you're going to have a moment, an inequality moment, and there will be some kind of legislation. To the extent that you get only so many whacks at the inequality, you want to make them the right. most efficient ones possible. And so the question is, if you raise the minimum wage, do you create a situation in which people say, okay, well, we took care of the inequality thing, and now we won't do this more effective measure? I don't know, but it right. just seemed like it that.
Or the other way to argue it is, there's no chance that you get an expansion of the earned income tax credit, and so better the minimum wage than nothing. Although I'm not sure that I agree that one is less or more. They both seem so politically out of reach right now. It's hard to say, like, oh, the minimum wage is plausible.
There's a psychological benefit that you get from getting higher wages. I mean, I have employed people,
right.
and when you give somebody a raise, people are happier having a raise right. than knowing that at the end of the year, the government, which is a form of uncertainty for people, when people don't understand their taxes in the best of circumstances, right. like the idea that, oh, yes, this magical refund will be slightly higher. It's not the same as saying you're going to have $3 extra an hour. Also, the fact is that we have a much lower minimum wage than counterpart economies. If you look at European economies, minimum wages are significantly higher than ours. Now, you know, they have higher unemployment rates, but even in a relatively flexible place like the UK, there's a minimum wage that's higher. I mean, that's a good point. It's a fair point, John.
Like, well, I don't know.
That efficient, maybe you aspire for efficiency.
I just think that if you're not going to get a huge omnibus bill, and so you want to pick their smartest shots. And that seems to be an argument that is slightly different also than the traditional ones with the minimum wage, right? Because we feel like
we've
been through these.
I have one other point, which is that I just thought of this.
Okay.
Which is, insofar as this is a national movement by a union, private sector union, to do this, they know there's no chance that this can happen at the federal level. They are aware of that. They're not stupid people. What this is an attempt to put pressure on individual states, I suspect, to make people at the state level realize, oh, there's inequality, and to get places like, as Washington, D.C. did. Washington, D.C., just, you know, significantly upped its minimum wage, and to make the case that having a higher minimum wage, as 19 states do, is something that can be economically beneficial for you. And you can't do that with earned income tax credit.
Right.
Right. But we do have tremendous regional variation in terms of the cost of living. And so for that reason, could you argue that actually the state-by-state solution in this case is particularly preferable and just a good idea to try?
Maybe, yeah.
One other thing just about the politics of the inequality agenda. I mean, clearly it is a issue that needs to be dealt with. But when you look at the president and where, you know, his approval ratings are low, people are talking about him already as a lame duck. The number of people who were talking about the fact that he's going to stay in town after he's out of office so that his daughter can continue her high school. I mean, that's 3 years from now. And yet people were sort of already kind of talking about it like he was on the cusp of the threshold to leave. One of the powers he still has is the kind of convening conversation power, which is he can get everybody talking about something. And to the extent that he did that this week with this speech about inequality, it helps Democrats who can, you know, this is a topic they can sink their teeth into.
Yeah, but I don't think he had anything to do with it. I don't think his speech had anything to do with it. I think it's the fast food strikes are what's getting people talking about it.
Well, that's probably true. And there's no question that people have been talking. I mean, the Occupy movement was about income inequality. So, yeah, he didn't discover it. But I think that to the extent that his conversation has been about a website and his healthcare plan, that if he can move the Washington conversation to inequality, it's a much better space for Democrats, a better thing for Democrats to be talking about than why the healthcare program isn't working. And since the healthcare program is a part of this inequality, it just kind of gets everybody onto a familiar song sheet that they know and that they can feel strong about and that turns out their voters in a non-presidential election year when you want to do that. So though this has merit, there's also a lot of political benefit too.
Okay. That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture GabFest starts right now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, Getting On, it's the new boundary-pushing HBO show about the elderly. And then the crossword puzzle turns 100 years old this year, and we'll talk about its history and future with the irreplaceable Will Shortz. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And filling in for Dana Stevens this week is Slate's editorial director, the august John Swansburg. Hey, John.
Hey, Steve. Feeling very august this morning.
I know. You're looking very august. I'd say we have, like, what, two-thirds of the org chart of Slate magazine here, the power structure? When you two are in the same room, does Plotz need to be in an undisclosed location?
Yeah, him and the Postmaster General have to be somewhere else.
Exactly. All right. Well, anyway, Getting On is the new HBO comedy. It's begun a 6-episode season. The show is based on a British television series. It's set in an extended care unit of a California hospital. It's filmed in the shaky handheld documentary style of Larry Sanders and the original British version of The Office. It stars Laurie Metcalf as Dr. Jenna James and Niecy Nash as Nurse Dee Dee. Why don't we listen to a clip from the show before we discuss?
Found a feces in a chair. No. The incident reports need to be really, really specific.
Okay, what else should I put?
Well, for starters, it's not a feces, it's just feces.
But, I mean, it wasn't a gang of them, it was just one piece.
But there's no singular form for feces. It's not feces or a feces, it's just feces. Who found it?
Me.
And when did they find it?
I found it. See, this is my name right here.
Technically, because it's a potential agent of infection, we would have environmental services come down to collect it, but the backlog is horrendous. So I'm just going to go ahead and have you red bag it.
If it'll make it quicker, I could just pick it up with a Kleenex, wipe off the chair with some bleach. Boom.
Yeah, that might be what you do at home, but you cannot do that in the hospital. There's
somehow divorced from the video, that sounds funnier than I found the experience of watching this show to be. This show is so grim. I get that it's ostensibly a comedy. It runs in a half-hour time slot, but it is bleak as all get out. The cutaway between jokes, and you're right, Steve, that it sort of has a verite, awful fluorescent office light vibe, even though it's not a mockumentary the way The Office was. But it has that sort of real feeling. But literally the way they land the jokes in the show is that somebody will say something modestly funny in a dark way, and then the camera will cut away to the vacant stare of some dying octogenarian just like sitting on an oxygen tube looking vacantly at our key players, the nurses. And then it will like cut back to more grim action about feces and hospital forms and whatever else. I sort of admired parts of this show, but I found it almost laughably grim. And the notion of tuning into it willingly seemed far, far from my future as a television viewer.
I will never tune into this show. Unless I'm forced to, partially for that reason.
Well, okay, but here's a question, John. It's gotten, I agree with you, I'm never going to tune into it again either, but it got these glowing reviews. The New York Times really liked it. Slate's own Willa Paskin, a terrific TV critic, loved it. She raved about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, you described it in the intro as being a boundary-pushing show about old people, but I think one reason that I didn't like it is that I didn't find it to be either boundary-pushing or about old people. I guess it is boundary pushing in the sense that it's, you know, it makes jokes about feces and they're, you know, they're, it's somewhat outre in its subject matter occasionally. But really it does to me feel like The Office. It feels like a comedy of bureaucracy of a type that I'm now very used to, though these many years after the original Office aired. And the other thing that, that critics seemed to be responding to was that it was somehow a more nuanced and interesting portrait of aging and the elderly than where we've grown accustomed to in recent times on network television, where old people have just become the butt of jokes. And to me, that's just wasn't the case in the two episodes that we watched. The old people are either, as Julia said, just kind of vacantly staring zombies who are meant to punctuate jokes, or they're these wild caricatures of the like racist, homophobic old person that struck me as being completely a gross portrait of the type that I would expect to find on a dumb CBS comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I was completely disappointed in it. I sort of pushed for us to do this segment because a hobby horse of me as I get older and as I socialize with people who are 10 or 15, 20 years older than I am, who are, you know, at this point over the age of 65, right? I am struck over and over again about how our perception of old people is totally predetermined by the demographic fact, not so much of their aging, but of their inaccessibility to advertisers, right? The premium cohort is 18 to 49, because during that period in your life, you're relatively easy to sell to. But once a person turns 50, they're much less vulnerable to that kind of a pitch. And therefore, they lack value to advertisers. And therefore, they're treated as not intrinsically valuable in many media representations, which to me is just a pathetic failing of the culture. And it's really culminated in the recent few TV seasons where old people are depicted as these, you know, irritants, burdens, or comically infantile adults. And it's just awful. So when I read that there was a show on television that might humanize the process of growing old the way that the remarkable movie by Michael Haneke, Amour, did, I thought, oh, my God, this is remarkable. Let's, of course, do it. We can talk about this one social type that we're allowed to completely void of their humanity, which are the elderly, and the corrective of this TV show. And lo and behold, I tune in, and it's the same. John, you're exactly right. It's the exact same repertoire of self-congratulatory, envelope-pushing, sex and jokes that premium cable was pioneering, quote-unquote pioneering, 25 years ago. It's the same stuff, barely in a new cast. I was just amazed at how unfunny it was.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's so disappointing at the show is that all of the old people in it are either props or catalysts of the action, but their subjectivity is never explored at all. You know, they're merely there to be responded to by the nurses and doctors who work on this ward. And it feels like it would have been much more inventive and groundbreaking to do something different and more ambitious. I mean, it's an HBO show. It's not subject to the same advertising pressures that you describe. You know, why not actually make a show set in an old age home that's from the point of view of the old people?
Yeah. And also, I mean, think about, okay, so in addition to having a subjectivity that we ought to honor just because that's the human thing to do, people who are older are presumably repositories of wisdom. They are repositories of memory and cultural memory. They have actually something to teach us, right? They actually are an accumulation of time in an individual's subjectivity and a perspective on what the entire arc of a life might be like, as opposed to these, you know, kind of comic relief ninnies. I mean, it's just, and the show ought to be about that in a way. I mean, it ought to be about the fact that we warehouse old people, right? That the modern nuclear domestic bourgeois family exiles its old people, which is an act repeated symbolically by the whole culture, because we don't take them seriously. We don't listen to them. We tune them out. We lend them no authority because we're, you know, since the 60s, we've been a youth culture effectively. And the show could be about that because it's literally about such a warehouse. And so this immensely wasted perspective is now stuck in this horrible, benighted corner of the world. That's a really profound, tragic irony. The show doesn't have to be one whit less clever, I mean, in the sense of laugh out loud, funny jokes, in order to do this, and yet it squanders the opportunity, you know, completely.
It was really striking, I thought, that one of the worst characters in the first two episodes, and to my mind, was this woman who comes in to the ward and is just a racist, is calling people fairies, and is being awful to the black nurse. And the actress playing that role was June Squibb, who was in the recent film Nebraska, which you guys discussed. And in this show, she is this completely ridiculous caricature. And in Nebraska, she was this wonderful, you know, fully-fledged character who was cranky and strong-willed, but a gossip, you know, sort of things you associate maybe with old people. But she was also surprisingly ribald and capable of sweetness and just, you know, was a very interesting and fully-fledged elderly person. And seeing that same actress on screen playing this completely reduced version of old age was just particularly striking, having just seen her do quite the opposite.
Getting On is the new HBO comedy. It's begun a 6-episode season. We're all in accord here. 3 thumbs up.
The great show about the elderly is yet to be made.
Yes, okay. So maybe a skip it here. But look, I mean, Willa Paskin is no joke. She's a great TV critic, and she loved it. So presumably some of you do, too. If you think we got this one totally wrong, come to our Facebook page. What's our Facebook page address?
Facebook.com/CultureFest.
Senior moment there, Steve.
Very, yes. All right, well, moving on. Coming up, Will Shortz on the 100th anniversary of the crossword puzzle. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with John Swansburg and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for things we mention on the program, we collect them at our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. December 2013 marks the 100th anniversary of the crossword puzzle. Joining us to discuss this legacy is none other than its most prominent steward. Will Shortz's name has appeared on every crossword, so I've read, that the New York Times has published since November 1993. He's been described as the most powerful man in puzzles, and we're very honored to have him on our modest little show. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Will, before we talk about the history of the puzzle, let's talk a little bit about your history. Like everyone who hears you every weekend on NPR, I'm thinking two things simultaneously. Even as I play along with the word challenge, I'm wondering, how did this guy end up with what is so clearly his dream job?
Well, I've been a puzzle head, I would say, since I was a kid. I started making puzzles when I was 8 or 9. I sold my first one when I was 14 and became a regular contributor to Dell Puzzle magazines when I was 16. And you probably know I have the world's only college degree in enigmatology, the study of puzzles.
That is so awesome. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the state of the crossword puzzle in 1993 when you arrived at the New York Times, and then how you evolved the art of creating crosswords for them since?
Yeah, well, I came from a younger generation of puzzlers. It was called the New Wave. And my predecessor, Eugene Maleska, was 37 years older than me, and he had a classical background. So the puzzles had sort of a staid feeling to them. They were classical with a lot of opera, Latin. The editor of the New York Times Magazine told me when I took over that if there was any reference in the puzzle to something more recent than 25 years, it came as a shock. And my feeling was that the crossword should embrace everything in life and all the people who were doing the puzzle. So I wanted to keep the older solvers and keep the older and classical knowledge, but I also wanted to have pop culture and just everything that's going on in the world.
It was actually your arrival at the New York Times, Will, that I think introduced me to crossword puzzles. My grandmother was a devoted doer of the New York Times crossword puzzle for many years, who loved opera and had studied Latin and had like whole passages of romantic poetry committed to memory. And when you arrived on the scene, she started complaining about the puzzle and some of these clues that she didn't understand. And so she had me come stand over her beach chair and start doing the puzzle with her and help her decipher some of the younger and fresher clues. So my love of crossword puzzles, I think, probably dates to her calling upon me for help.
That is great. You know, a tough crossword is a good way for people to get together and solve together, especially between generations, because you know things your grandmother didn't and vice versa, and it makes a great pairing, especially on a hard puzzle.
Yes, I still remember my grandmother introducing to me the fact that Asa Gray was a noted botanist. And I still don't know anything more about Asa Gray than that he was a noted botanist, which I think brings me to one of the critiques of crossword puzzles, or a criticism often made by crossword skeptics, which is that it does not actually instill in you deep knowledge about the world, because you end up learning a set of fairly constricted patterns. You learn crosswordese, you learn the sorts of names of people like Asa Gray, who have beautifully symmetrical vowel-filled first names that are nice and short and who end up in the crossword, but you don't actually keep up on the things of the world. It's a very limited set of knowledge that it relies on. Do you have a standard reply for such skeptics and complainants?
I do, and you're right. Crosswords do not foster deep knowledge of things. What they do is introduce you in a superficial way to lots of things that you might not know about otherwise. So you had never read about Asa Gray before, but now if Asa Gray comes up in everyday life, you are acquainted with the name, you have a little familiarity with it, and you're more likely to delve more deeply into that subject. And that's true of whatever the subject, the Bible, rap music, whatever. You get a superficial knowledge in it, some acquaintance with it, and then you can develop that further later.
I would also add that I think it really improves one's vocabulary. I mean, obviously, there are certain words that show up again and again because of their utility. You know, you see epay a lot, you see aria a lot, you see luau a lot. I mean, those are probably words you already knew if you're approaching a crossword. But I was doing today's puzzle this morning, and I came across the word odontalgia, which I confess I did not know. I gather it means toothache from having solved the clues around it. But that was a word I didn't know, and now hopefully it'll stick in my head and my vocabulary will have improved by one from just doing a Tuesday puzzle. And I think that's really great. And it's obviously not an isolated example. I feel like doing puzzles my whole adult life has really helped me not necessarily always learn words, but sometimes cement what their meaning is. Like sometimes I'll guess at it because I think the word is right and it'll turn out to be proven correct by the rest of the puzzle. And then that really will cement that word and its meaning in my mind in a way that I'm really grateful for.
That's right. And odontalgia, you can sort of figure out from the parts that the odont refers to tooth and alga is an something painful like neuralgia. So you can sort of figure it out. And you just hope that this introduction of this new word into your brain doesn't knock something else out.
Right, that's the danger.
I was interested to read that you try to strike out crosswordese, words like étui, the small decorative case for needles, which I certainly learned from doing your crosswords. But I find I have sort of a fondness for the random crossword-only words. Like, it makes me happy. It feels like a secret code that I'm aware of. And when I do crosswords with my husband, who doesn't do them and isn't a puzzler, he's always, like, astonished when I can, you know, just pull out that Edam is obviously a Dutch cheese. And he's like, what the hell? Like, Gouda, maybe. And I'm like, no, it's Edam cheese. Come on. I like that sort of insider's code. But so is your ideal New York Times crossword puzzle one that strips that out and doesn't have any of that in it?
No, I think that goes too far. I think a little difficult vocabulary is all right. The words, I don't mind étui too much because I actually run across that occasionally in real life. The words that I'd like to eliminate, if possible, are ones that you never see in everyday life. In older crosswords, if you go back 30, 40 years, you'll see this word I-N-E-E. It's pronounced ine, and it means arrow poison. And you have to go back to a 1911 dictionary to find any reference work with that word in it. So that is a word that I'm proud to say has never appeared in a New York Times crossword since I've been the editor.
So on the popular culture stuff, it sort of presented a similar but different problem. How do you decide when something in popular culture is meaningful enough, not so ephemeral, that it can be included in the New York Times puzzle? It's obviously you don't want to do something that's some kind of flash-in-the-pan story of the week that only someone who is devouring everything on Twitter is going to get.
Right.
How do you decide when Most Def, whose name is useful, I think, probably in constructing puzzles, is popular enough, well-known enough, that it can find its way into a puzzle?
Yeah, that's a great question. I read a lot. I go to the movies. And so I soak up what the average person soaks up and just make an independent judgment. I'll tell you a story. Back in the late 90s, when Britney Spears had her hit Oops, I Did It Again, and someone sent me a crossword with that running across the middle of the grid. That was a number one song that week, and so he thought that was a cool thing to put in the puzzle. You know, but there are lots of number one hits that don't have staying power. You know, we forget them 3 or 4 weeks later. So I wrote him that I wasn't going to accept this puzzle because I didn't think that had seeped into popular culture yet, popular knowledge. But let's see how that name develops. And 6 months later, after that song seemed to have staying power, he sent me the puzzle again, and I ran it.
Huh. That's great.
Actually, you're reminding me of a crossword puzzle that my dad loved so much that he regularly describes the crossword puzzle as an anecdote that he tells people with some success, which is after the 1996 election, there was a crossword puzzle that had as a clue last night's victor and was solvable with either the 7 letters Bob Dole or the 7 letters Clinton because all of the down clues.
The story is even better than that.
All right, yeah, so
that
I wanted to ask.
That appeared on Election Day, Tuesday in 1996, when Clinton and Bob Dole were running for president. And the clue was headline in tomorrow's newspaper. And the answer could be either Clinton elected or Bob Dole elected. And so that puzzle appeared to predict the results of that day's election. But, of course, either answer worked.
That delighted my father so much. And I feel like they're particularly rampant in Wednesday's puzzles for some reason. I love when there's a gimmick or some kind of unexpected little turn in the puzzle that takes it beyond just filling out answers to clues. So that is my father's favorite. But I'm curious, what is the puzzle game or gimmick that has most delighted you in your years of curating the New York Times crossword?
Oh, that's it right there. That is
really?
My all-time favorite crossword.
Your dad has great taste.
Fantastic. Good to
What's
know.
Your second favorite?
Second favorite? Well, the one that jumps to mind is a wedding proposal, a marriage proposal that was done through the Times crossword. There was a young lawyer in Manhattan who left a message on my answering machine at the Times saying that his girlfriend was crazy about the Times crossword, and he asked me if he could propose to her through the puzzle. And my first thought was, no, this is a puzzle, that millions of people do. I can't put a message in a crossword just for you. And then I thought about it some more, and I thought there might be a way to do this. So I asked Bob Kwan, who's a noted puzzle maker, to create this special puzzle. And the long answers were A Modest Proposal, which was the title of a Jonathan Swift pamphlet from 1726. And across the middle of the grid was This Diamond Ring, which was a Gary Lewis and the Playboys hit in the 60s. And toward the bottom of the grid was Will You Marry Me, which was a Paula Abdul hit in the 90s. So Bob incorporated these. He also put the guy's name and the girl's name. And at the bottom of the grid, he had the answer, yes. And the clue for that was hoped for answer to, you know, Will You Marry Me? So we arrange, Bill is the name of the man. We arranged for the day that this puzzle would appear in the Times. He took the day off from work. He and his girlfriend went to their favorite brunch place in Manhattan, picked up the Times along the way. They sat across the table from each other. As was her custom, the girl, Emily, started solving the crossword. Bill is pretending to read the headlines, but he's keeping his eye on her. And as she's solving along, she sees the marriage proposal theme. She says, oh, look, my name's in this puzzle. And she says, oh, look, your name's in this puzzle. She's afraid to say anything in case it's all a coincidence. And when she gets to the end, she looks at him and says, this puzzle. And he asked, will you marry me? And she said, yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God.
Oh, my
That's
Lord.
That's amazing.
Wow.
That is amazing. I think if you asked any one of us to marry you right now, the answer would be yes. You could be a thrigamist. Well, okay, so this all raises an interesting question, which I was surprised to discover that the New York Times, which is obviously the standard bearer for the crossword puzzle, only took it up pretty late in the history of the puzzle in 1942. But since then, obviously, it's just been on the cutting edge of it, and it's central to the newspaper. How tied is the crossword puzzle to the fate of a print newspaper?
You know, crosswords, there's more than 50,000 people who now subscribe to the New York Times crossword online. So the puzzle is popular in electronic form. But I think a lot of people feel, as I do, that the puzzle, a crossword, is better suited for print than for the electronic medium. It's easier to see all the clues at once and in print, and it's easier to jump around from one part of the grid to the next. So I think, first of all, a lot of people get the paper for the print edition, and also the crossword literally makes millions of dollars for the newspaper.
Well, I'm curious what you think about the future of crosswords. I mean, do you think 100 years from now people will still be doing them, or do you think that the puzzle is sort of a product of this particular moment and that a different mode of puzzling will have captured our heart 100 years hence?
Yeah, I think crosswords are timeless. And crosswords are the best variety of puzzle ever made because they tap into something deep inside us, a love of language and the love of things. It's a very flexible form of puzzle. You can make them big and or small, easy and hard, themed or regular. There's a crossword for everybody. And I think they'll be with us forever.
I certainly hope so.
All right. Well, Will Shortz is the New York Times puzzle editor. It was our immense privilege to have you on the show. Your voice is so familiar to me. It's wonderful for it to join us today. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse John Swansburg. What do you have?
So I thought I'd do a crossword-themed endorsement. I love crosswords, the standard kind, but actually my favorite type of puzzle is not the daily crossword, but the acrostic, which runs every other week in the New York Times Magazine. And it's a slightly different kind of puzzle. If you haven't seen it before, it's you're basically trying to figure out a quote. Usually the quote comes from a book. And the way it works is the quote is kind of laid out in a crossword-esque grid, but the way you figure out which letters go in that grid is by solving a series of clues. Usually there are about 25, and there's a clue, and then you fill in the answer, and then the answer corresponds to a box, and it sounds so much more complicated than it actually is, but it's super fun. And it's I'd say it's like a little bit more challenging than the daily crossword, or maybe it's about as challenging as a Friday daily crossword. But it's really cool. At the end, you've solved this quote from a book, and then the first letter of each of the clues that you've solved spell out the name of the book and the author. So creating this puzzle seems like it's really intricate, and this husband-wife team, Henry Rathbone and Emily Cox, write it every week. They're really fun, and if you are a crossword fan and you've never done it, I highly recommend it. It's a great way of whiling away a Sunday afternoon.
Oh, it sounds so cool. Yeah, I used to love doing the acrostic. Julia, what do you got?
I have kind of a cheese ball endorsement this week, but I've just been listening to this song over and over again. So I, like all sentient humans, I'm a Beatles fan and have vaguely picked up on the fact that Wings, the after project of Paul McCartney, is much derided and loathed as being inferior and a sad mark, a sad blight upon the history of music, because the Beatles were no more and Paul McCartney was off doing whatever the hell he was doing with Wings in some Baroque 70s grotesquerie. However, I've just recently started listening to the song Let Me Roll It, which is just a cheeseball song, but it is such a beautiful love song. It is such a great song, and somehow the sum total of its chords and the kind of repetitive chorus and lyrics and the beauty of the leap of faith of my heart is like a wheel, let me roll it to you, the recurring lyric, is gorgeous. It just feels like what it feels like to luxuriate in the warmth of love, and it's a beautiful love song. So Let Me Roll It, Wings, late era Paul McCartney.
Okay. All right. Well, very quickly, were it not for the idiosyncrasy and editorial courage of Peter Kaplan of the New York Observer, I would never have segued from graduate school into journalism. Peter Kaplan died this past week of cancer at the terrifically sad premature age of 59. He is one of the few editors, print journalist editors in my lifetime, who I really believe deserves to be called legendary. There have been many encomia eulogies to him on the web. They are worth seeking out. Peter Kaplan was just an unfailingly decent and an utterly charming human being. He is sorely missed. John Swansburg, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Julia Turner, a delight.
As always.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Chris Wade and Mike Volo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll talk to you next week.